I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about, well, one of the institutions in American public life that is one of the most important, perhaps one of the least understood, and we certainly know from public opinion surveys, one of the least respected institutions in the United States, and that is the United States Congress. But we're going to be talking about what Congress was meant to be, what it has become, and perhaps what it can become again if with the proper reforms and proper thinking and understanding about Congress by those citizens and by those in Congress themselves. Really important conversation today about the place of Congress in American public life. I'm joined for that conversation with our old friend, a terrific scholar of Congress, Professor Mac Mariani. Those of you who don't know Mac, he is professor of political science at Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. He's also director of the American Founding and Constitution Program at Xavier. He has a bachelor's degree from Canisius College and his PhD from the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. He teaches courses on Congress. He teaches courses on the executive, on the United States Constitution, and American politics more broadly. Mac is a widely published author, terrific book on political parties called Diverging Parties, and he's published a number of scholarly works in very well-respected journals like Political Science Quarterly and Legislative Studies Quarterly. He also, besides being a scholar of Congress, has been directly involved with Congress as a legislative aide and press secretary for a U.S. congressman, and in fact, interned in the United States Congress way back when Jack Kemp was in Congress from the western part of New York. So we've got someone who knows the practice of Congress, knows the theory of Congress, for a conversation today about that institution. Mac Mariani, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American
Idea. Thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
What was Congress meant to be?
Well, you know, I think that the when you look at the, certainly when you look at the as scholars, what we have to do is we have to look at, you know, what was said and what was written at the time of the founding. I don't know if we're all originalists in that sense, but the founders told us, certainly you can look back to Madison's notes from the convention. You could look at the Federalist Papers and what Hamilton and Madison and Jay said about Congress. I think that, when we think about where the founders were at that particular constitutional moment, you know, they were moving away from the Articles of Confederation, which was, the Articles of Confederation only had a Congress, right? There was no executive branch or legislative or judicial branch. There was just a one house Congress. But I think it's important to sort of recognize that they didn't view that as a government at all, right? It was a league of friendship. It was a confederacy, right? A confederacy of sovereign nations. If you look back on those first three points in the articles, the first three articles in the Articles of Confederation, and they're very clear about that, right? They're like, these states are sovereign. This is a league of friendship. It had very limited purposes. And if you look at the state legislatures, which they considered their nations at the time, all of those were had a more balanced. They did have executive branches and judicial branches, and that goes back to sort of the longstanding sort of understanding that there's a need to have a separation of powers. There's a need to have an institution that is somewhat monarchical, an executive, right, that has these sort of monarchical tendencies. Now, we had very limited ideas about what that meant, right? We didn't want a full-on monarch, but we recognized the need for energy and administration There was a judicial branch, right, that had to exercise a certain amount of judgment. There was also an aristocratic branch, like a Senate in most places, except for maybe Pennsylvania, I think, lacked that. I think Pennsylvania for a time lacked an executive, a true executive as well. They were sort of on the far end of things, but they were sort of the exception. Most of the other states, they had a governor, they had a Senate, they had a House, which is the House was the Democratic body. But certainly, the spirit of the time was that the legislature was the right place to ground things, right? The legislature, as balanced between a House and a Senate, would be a place to put the power, the legislative power that existed in society, and that was the power to write laws, which was seen as the most important of all the powers. You look back at the Constitution. And, you know, one thing that tells you it's the most important, the legislature was the most important, is it's Article One. It's the first thing they're going to talk about. It's also the longest relative to the judicial branch. And, you look at the long list of powers in Article One, Section 8 that are given to Congress, right? That's a pretty clear indicator of, hey, these are the powers of this new national government. And we're going to enumerate them. So it's a somewhat of a long list. And then you get to the presidency. And the presidency is sort of weak sauce. There's some powers there, but not a lot, right? And to the extent that they point to them, they sort of point to them. Well, the executive power goes to the president, right? Now that's been interpreted in much more broad strokes. What is all of the executive power goes to the executive is a pretty important thing. But I think when you look at what the founders were saying, particularly the Federalist Papers, it's pretty clear that the intention was that the legislature would drive, that the legislature would drive, this government. And that the president would serve, in the words of Jeffrey Toulis, more as a clerk, an administrator.
All right, let me pursue that a little bit. As you say, so Article One is the first article. That's the legislative branch. It's the longest article. There's a lot of enumerated powers there. I think there's Article One, Section A, maybe 18 different enumerations of power. I think that's right. That means that Congress, as you said, was supposed to be the center of activity in making laws for the whole nation under its enumerated powers. It was really going to be the place where the action was. And the president would play, I don't want to say a subservient role, but a role that was distinct from and not having the driving the action in the way that Congress would be. Now, of course, early on, even in the 1790s under the Washington administration, this is the ideal setup for the Constitution that the Federalist Papers talk about. But early on, we get controversies between President Washington and Congress over things like foreign affairs. And I'm thinking about, for example, Washington's proclamation of that the U.S. would essentially be neutral in the war between Britain and France. And some people in Congress said, wait, the president is usurping our congressional power. What about these early controversies between Congress and the president?
Sure. So one of the things while the initial thinking is, hey, Congress is going to be the center of things. And, in fact, that was the defense from I think it was Hamilton in the Federalist Papers that, listen, because in a republic, these legislatures tend to dominate and tend to be the ones that sort of go off balance. We need to make sure to fortify the presidency with things like the veto, and we need to fortify the presidency to the extent that it has powers over appointments and other things like that. One of the first controversies, right, is about the appointment power of the presidency, right? Because under the articles, Congress Congress had all the power of appointments, and the Constitution does say the presidents can appoint, and the Senate has to approve and consent to those approvals. But was unclear at that point is what could the president fire the appointees, right? Or would that have to go back to the Senate, right? And which I think is very interesting to think about an alternative history where, you know, ultimately Congress decides that's not a power we want. Right. And they're sort of recognizing this is a precedent. Right. The Constitution doesn't say anything about that. And you can imagine that if, you know, President Trump had in his first term and submitted a name and the Senate had concurred to it. That, you know, entirely possible that they, you know, it gets end up getting held over into the Biden administration, right? You'd end up having these, and it would sort of shift the dynamic, right? Who are these appointees responsible to? Are they responsible to the president alone, or do they also have to balance that with a need to keep the senators happy? So that's, I think, one good example of an early controversy. And certainly the presidents, you know, those early presidents, I think the presidency was immediately bigger than the founders sort of thought it would be. And in part, it was because the personality, you know, we're talking about George Washington and Adams and Jefferson, right? These are larger than life sort of figures on the national stage. And so the president, the idea that these men would just be mere clerks, mere administrators at the whim of Congress, you sort of fanciful if you think about it, right? So of course they immediately became much more powerful than I think Congress, the members of Congress maybe were always comfortable with, but also more comfortable than the founders initially thought they would be.
Mm. Obviously, two of the big powers that Congress has enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, one is the power of taxation, but the other is, of course, the power to declare war. And there are a lot of controversies, it seems like, that have come up with talking about what Congress was meant to be and what it has become, particularly over Congress's war power. And I'm thinking, you know, for example, the War of 1812, and there's members of Congress who are pushing hard for war against Britain. And you've got a president like James Madison who seems very reluctant to go down that path. What about the war power of Congress and the controversies in you know, for the first 100 or 150 years of Congress?
Well, you know, I think so. War is really important because, and for a couple of reasons. One is once we do go to war, and certainly Congress played a much larger role than they do in the 20th century. Congress largely, you know, stop declaring wars, right? Officially, which, you know, you could say technically, right? Like when we went to Iraq, they passed a resolution that essentially had the same effect, right? It didn't say declaration of war over the top of it, but it, you know, it basically was a legitimization of the conflict. Whether we, you know, whatever we call it, you know, and so first of all, there's that power to declare war. Secondly, there's the budgetary control that Congress has. And, you know, I think one of the challenges that the Congress often faces, and certainly it's a 20th century problem, probably also a 19th century problem as well, is the Congress is ultimately responsible to the voters, right? And getting on the, you know, when you get in this sort of war fever that goes on, it gets hard. You know, you see this even in Iraq more contemporarily, where, you know, and Afghanistan, where, you know, President Obama had been like, hey, I oppose this war, but, you know, we don't get out of it, right? It just sort of just, you know, because it's hard once you're sort of involved, it gets harder. And even the Democratic Congress found it hard to, like, are we going to defund the troops while they're in the field? There's all sorts of sort of technical reasons that the presidency is advantaged. I also think that the president has some advantages. When you do look at the Constitution, that's where, you know, the president has, I said, weak sauce when it comes to powers, but it's in that area of foreign policy, you know, when it comes to treaty making, when it comes to appointing foreign affairs officers, when it comes to receiving diplomats. It seems to be a lot of the president's powers and a lot of the president's unchecked powers sort of fall in that area of foreign policy. I also think, especially when we get into the modern era, when presidents have access to the CIA and the National Security Agency and all these sort of briefings that they're getting, and the fact that they're going out and doing these trips and meeting with world leaders, you know, members of Congress are less, they're just less equipped to push back on the State Department, right, which has, you know, many, many thousands of employees who are briefing the president's aides. The president has gotten help. In those early Congresses, the president had less. And so you definitely see Congress playing a bigger role, the president having to manage that role. I think political parties, that's the other variable here that changes, right? You see what Jefferson introduces, sort of they have the first sort of nascent political parties existing in 1800. Jefferson starts to play a more active role in actually communicating to committee chairs, communicating to party leaders, and sort of working the agenda. Now there's people like J.S. Young and some others who suggest that that's probably a little bit overblown, that, you know, we look back and we'd be like, oh, he's leading the party and he's directing everything that goes on in Congress. And really, that was probably done on the margins. It was, the president's hand in Congress was probably not as heavy as we would interpret it today. But nonetheless, you start to see the president starting to sort of maneuver into the legislative arena, in part because how important presidents are, their stature, and also the fact that the parties and presidents are linked together, right? Like the members of Congress are linked to the president's party in terms of their success when it comes to going to election. So the emergence of parties is another variable that changes things.
It does seem like whether you're talking about the war power or the foreign affairs power, or whether you're talking about the appropriations power of Congress, it does seem like there, if you look at American history, the powers of Congress, at least for a long time, kind of ebbed and flowed so that there'd be periods of congressional dominance. And then you'd have an event like the Civil War, where obviously then the president becomes a driver of policy and is presenting things that essentially Congress just ratifies for Lincoln in many ways. And then you have a period after the Civil War of congressional dominance again, it seems like, where you have weaker presidents. You know, you ask people who was the president in 1885 and nobody knows because Congress was really powerful then. But then it seems like Congress, over the course of the 20th century, as you were mentioning, kind of declines as the center of action. And that ebb and flow that we saw previously begins to, is it fair to say, it becomes a permanent ebb or a much longer ebb? And Congress over time, since the 20th century, has gotten weaker and weaker, and the presidency has gotten stronger and stronger.
Yeah, so Higgs talked about this as a sort of a ratchet theory of presidential power and executive power, as well as sort of just the general size and scope of the government itself, with the idea that when you have this crisis, right, there's, you know, hey, we've got to push powers, into Lincoln's hands, right? We've got to push powers into the hands of the president who's dealing with a crisis. And what happens is that the presidency assumes some powers, and after the crisis abates, the things sort of ratchet down, but they don't ratchet down to where they were before, right? The president sort of, that clicks in. And then when you get to the 20th century, and I think with Johnson, one of the things that led to that ratchet being a little bit lower was the fact that Johnson is sort of an interloper, right? He doesn't really belong, right? He's this Democrat, he's vetoing the Civil Rights Act. He's standing in the way. He almost gets impeached, right? So that probably ratchets down a bit more than it would have otherwise. If that had been a Republican, Lincolnian vice president, the Congress might have ceded more power more permanently to the presidency. But once we get to the 20th century, that ratchet is pretty heavy-handed because you've got World War I, you've got World War II, and then you have the Cold War. Right, we pretty much spend the entire 20th century in a state of crisis until 1989, when the wall falls, I suppose. And
that's, of course, political. That's sort of internationally. What about a crisis? I'm thinking of, and maybe it's not fair to call it a turning point in the Congress's power, but I'm thinking about the Great Depression and the New Deal. Yeah. And it seems there you have a very powerful, active president, Franklin Roosevelt. You've got a who's a Democrat. You've got a Democratic Congress, so they're of the same political party. And it seems like in a moment like that, Congress was willing to delegate a lot of its power to the executive branch.
I think that's true. And in one part of this, one of the things that's, I think, interesting, and one of the, when we think about what limited the presidency, during the 19th century, versus the 20th century, there was a lot, but one of the probably biggest factors is simply the executive branch did not have much help, right? You had, initially you had, and you could go back to the Brownlow Commission, right? Very famously said, I think it was 1936, the president needs help. Because when FDR first came in, there were only about 100 people working for the White House, right?
Hard to believe, right?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Right now, the support staff for the White House is thousands and many thousands. So you go back to the very beginning, 1802, with Jefferson, right? There wasn't really much of a government to run. So the presidential power was somewhat limited because there wasn't much for the federal government to do. I think I looked this up, and in 1802, there were only 4,000 non-military federal employees. 3,000 of them are postal workers.
Huh. Wow. Right?
So you have about 316 presidential appointees and 700 clerks, right? Essentially people moving paper, right? So again, the country's much smaller but it also was technologically and transportation-wise, getting from, it was much harder to actually extend the power. So there's these sort of transportation and technological limits of communication. How do you govern things over the course of things? And then there's the idea that the federal government just barely exists, right? It just doesn't exist. Once you get to FDR, you see that not only do you see, at the very beginning of FDR, it's still pretty small, right? Again, 100 people, but it ramps up pretty quickly, right? And the number of federal employees explodes. The president's, if you go look at executive orders, in under FDR, even today, we talk about there's so many executive orders, just absolutely dwarfs anything that was done afterward. It's just, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, and obviously dwarfs those that came before. So the president all of a sudden is using that executive power dramatically. I think that also comes out of a sort of switch in thinking about the presidency, which is, he's really living out the Woodrow Wilson vision for the presidency, right? Wilson had come in, he's a political scientist, and he had written his thesis essentially on sort of the limits of Congress. The fact that the real barrier for the American system is the separation of powers, right? And Congress is just really poorly suited to the challenges of modern life, and modern life being in the 1880s and 1890s. Congressional committees were not transparent. This is before C-SPAN and all of that. They were not transparent. They were parochial. They weren't representing the entire nation. We tended to have committee government, right? Each committee sort of governed over whatever policies it was in charge of. The public had very little say in what was going on. They didn't really know what was going on until Congress did it. His vision for the presidency was this more rhetorical presidency. The president would speak over the heads of Congress to the nation, would use this sort of bully pulpit, to use Roosevelt's language, as a way of extending the president's power. Neustadt calls this sort of the power to persuade, right? Presidents don't have a lot of paper powers, but they do have the ability to convince people to do what they want them to do, whether it's Congress, because they are tied to them in terms of the political party, whether it's communicating to the public, because they have this high profile position and can use the power of rhetoric to shift public opinion in a direction that Congress feels forced to go. And he also just used, he used he assumed powers and extended powers that were beyond maybe what people thought they would ever be used for, like the power of the executive orders, the power to direct agencies to govern over, various bits of the American economy. Some of that got pulled back a bit by the courts, but he got most of what he wanted.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Yeah. So then if you think about it, as I understand what you're saying, you've got someone like Teddy Roosevelt, who clearly was a very active president. I don't know if this joke is true, but I've heard it apocryphally attributed to Teddy Roosevelt, which is when they call the roll in the Senate, the senators don't know whether to answer present or not guilty. So he had a dim view of Congress, let's just say. But then in theory, Woodrow Wilson says we need a much stronger executive to take over these things. And FDR actually puts it into practice in the crisis of the Great Depression, the New Deal, and World War II. And then it does seem like after that, you have presidents really of both political parties that sort of adopt this view that presidents should set the first 100 days, as they call it, set the legislative agenda when they're first elected. Their job is to move Congress, to do things. They're not serving Congress, but Congress is serving them. And certainly you get to the point where you have political scientists writing in the 60s and 70s of the imperial presidency. Like the president's become the emperor and Congress is just kind of like the old Roman Senate that does whatever the emperor basically tells it to do. Of course, then you have the crisis after Watergate, and it seems like maybe Congress revives itself to some degree. Is that what happened in the early 1970s or not?
Yes and no. I think certainly you start to see the Congress becoming, kind of engaging. There's this sort of shift towards investigations. I'm not quite sure. I mean, so part of this is the budget, right? The president controls the budget now. Since 1921, the passage of the Budget Act of 1921 essentially gave the president the power to sort of make the budget. The first budget comes from the president. Congress, before that, it was very decentralized. Congress controlled appropriations, and they still do control appropriations. They don't have to work off the president's budget, but just like Madison in the Constitutional Convention started the convention by slapping down the Virginia, the Virginia plan, and that becomes the starting point for debate. The president slaps down that budget. It's a much bigger boom, right? It's more of a and now we're going to be debating off of what the president's priorities are, right? That's a pretty huge thing. That doesn't end. The president still is shaping that. You also get the fact that Carter wins in 76. You can't help but wonder if Ford or Reagan had won in 76, whether the Democratic controlled Congress, and they had fairly large majorities back then, would have certainly after that 74 class, particularly whether Congress would have been stepped forward a little bit more than they did. But, that sort of ends up getting hijacked by like, okay, we're the Democrats, the big, huge class comes in 74. Congress is going to take a much bigger role. And then, then you get the Carter administration, right? And Carter's, everybody reverts back to what they used to do, which is let the president call the shots. And for the most part, that's what's going on there. And then once you get the Reagan era, it's sort of a nonstop series of investigations, which really have never ended, right? It's Congress, a big part of congressional activity and energy now is in generating investigations into their political opponents. The legislation part of it is a lot less fun.
What about, so then if we go back to the war powers, I'm thinking about the war powers resolution of the early 1970s. It seems to be Congress's attempt to push back on the president after the Vietnam War to say, hey, we're claiming the war power. It's our power to exercise. That's a core power of ours. We're not going to let the president do it. But it seems like that has had only a marginal effect because presidents still seem to engage in a lot of military action without a declaration of war. and maybe not even without authorization from Congress.
Yeah, and then one of the things you see is, I mean, you know, so one thing is that's difficult once we have troops in the field, it becomes difficult for Congress to politically not back troops in the field. That for whatever reason, that's changed. You know, I think we might be in a different era now after, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and sort of the futility of those wars. But the other part of it is that presidents have sort of figured out ways to either one, you get into a war and you have to build support for it. And it's in many ways a campaign, right? Like you've got to win, you know, public support so Congress wouldn't dare to defund it. But secondly, these sort of smaller actions, right, that sort of, you know, begin and end before the War Powers Resolution kicks in. I can't remember the exact, is it 100 days or some amount of time that the president has this sort of window of time to act with energy and dispatch, right? And then afterwards, Congress is going to sort of weigh in after the fact. So kind of Congress sort of cedes the ground to the presidency, right? If we're going to weigh in after the fact, once things start, it gets much more difficult for Congress to push back. And you look at these, you know, what Trump's doing with, boats out in that are coming in from Venezuela with drugs, and he's just blowing up the boats, right? Is each a separate military action, or is this a campaign, you know, a war or a campaign? The courts have also never weighed in on it, and so presidents have sort of thumbed their nose at it a bit, and I think there's a bit of fear on the part of Congress that you know, we don't want it to go to the courts ever because it's, you know, maybe even that thin reed upon which we, you know, we declare that we have autonomy and authority would sort of disappear.
Okay, that's a really interesting historical survey up to the present time. The question, though, is what was Congress meant to be? What has it become? What's the current state of Congress, in your opinion?
Well, I think there's a moment where, you know, I think Newt Gingrich, who was a historian, is sort of an interesting case study about like this. There was clearly an effort, and this is right around the time I was in Congress or working. I wasn't actually elected, so I was just there working for a member of the House of Representatives. But Gingrich is trying to sort of show, the Speaker of the House, Congress is supposed to be the first branch, right? We're supposed to lead the way. And he recognized that in order to do that, you have to have a speaker that's able to communicate, you know, to communicate to the American people. And there's a moment where he asks during the budget crisis, he asks for time on television to address the American people, and the networks turn him down. Right. They say, no, that's the president. You can respond when the president says something, but we're not giving you time to do that. And you can see that how like that would sort of shift things a bit. Now that was back in the day when you really only had, you know, three major networks and, you know, even in the early 90s, we had cable, but they weren't, you know, not quite the same. Like those networks really had a lot of power, back then. But he sort of recognized and tried to shift the power. But the challenge of a member of Congress or the Speaker of the House is that you don't have the unity of action that the president does, right? The president can just decide, this is my position, I'm going to stick to it, right? The Speaker has to keep all of the, you know, their majority in line. And we've been in a period of time where relatively narrow majorities. I think, you know, you don't see the sort of big 30 or 40 seat majorities that you used to see back in the day. These are very small majorities, which means it really empowers people on the fringes of each party to sort of put pressure on their leadership. So it's very, the leadership doesn't have the sort of flexibility to push back on the presidency that they might want to. So the result, you know, the result of what we end up getting is, to the extent that the Congress and congressional leadership sort of seizes control, is by these reconciliation bills, right? That we get this. We're gonna pass a reconciliation bill, and it's gonna be a giant bill that's gonna have 7,000 things in it. Or it's an omnibus bill of some sort. It might not always be a reconciliation bill. But One of these big giant bills with line. We're going to slip all sorts of things in there, and only the leadership and the task force that they've created is going to know what's in it. And you're going to have 2 days to pass it, right? And that's tends to be the way that Congress is sort of like, this is how this sort of brinksmanship. The problem with that is that both party leadership and both parties are invariably sort of passing things that the majority of the public doesn't like, right, and doesn't want. And there's a sort of a perverse incentive to sort of reward your base when you have control. And that has sort of made it harder there's not a long campaign where you're telling people about the legislation. This is what something that Woodrow Wilson talked about, that back and that what he called, I think, interpretation, this sort of back and forth between, he said, presidents are uniquely able to do this. And to some extent, he's right. It's very difficult for Congress to have that same communication about legislation, in part because when they act under regular order, they're very decentralized. They're doing a lot of things at once.
Question that I wanted to ask you, because that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a really interesting moment, important point. I've talked to several congressmen, even in recent years, who have said, boy, we need to return to regular order in Congress. If we want to take up and really exercise effectively the powers we have under the Constitution, we need to return to regular order. And I think for myself, and even for our listeners, what do they mean by regular order? What would Congress look like? How would it function? I'm thinking of that old Schoolhouse Rock, I'm just a bill, you know, only a bill, and they show you how it goes through Congress. Is that how Congress is working today or not?
Well, I think that's the idea. The idea is that regular order is essentially that we're going to use the committee process. And, you know, what committee process involves is there's information gathering and there's deliberation, right? You're going to have hearings. You're going to hear from people and hear what they think about a bill. You're going to deliberate with the members of the committee, go back and forth, majority, minority, and then you're going to bring that to the House, and you'll have a little bit of deliberation, but not as much, right? And so this process is how the public gets informed about there's a bill on the floor. The reality is the people who are mostly paying attention to things that are going on in committee anyway are the people who are sort of self-interested in what's going on in the committee. But, you know, most people are not sitting down and watching C-SPAN, you know, committee hearings. And so that's, you know, one challenge. It is difficult, especially because there's lots of hearings going on all the time, right? Like, so it's difficult for, the second thing is, because of partisanship, parties have moved away from that because they want to control the outcomes and I think this is important because it's not just the outcomes that matter, right? There's a certain amount of, brinksmanship and zero sum sort of mentality we get from the parties in Congress is in part due to the fact that they're sort of bypassing this part of the process in which you would have to talk with one another. I think that's one part of the problem. I think that the process is valuable there. I also think this is going to be very contrary to what you know, and maybe contrary to some of the things I've said, but I think there's too much transparency at the committee level.
Okay, and requires some explanation. What do you mean?
Yeah, so members of Congress are right now always performing. They're performing for donors. They're performing for constituents. Performing for the camera. A lot of them are theater kids now. So the Congress has become a bit of theater, right? A lot of theater. And, you know, there's been some of that all the time. Going back, certainly, you know, the folks who were, you know, I'm sure Daniel Webster was he's putting on a show too, right? But I think it really stands in the way of building the sort of, climate that allows for compromise, that allows for, like, and if you even say anything, in a committee hearing that reeks of compromise, you're going to get 1,000, you know, emails and 1,000 messages or 1,000 tweets about how you're a sellout, and you're, if you're on the Republican, you're a rhino. If you're on the Democratic side, you're, you know, some sort of, you know, siding with the fascists or whatever. So the sort of fringes of the public sort of prevent any sort of conversation about and any sort of effort to sort of build build towards consensus and compromise. And I think that having a space where members of Congress can do, right now it's illegal for them to do that, right? They can't do it under the Freedom of Information Law, right? They have to do their deliberating in public. And I actually think some of that would be good for them to have a space to actually have those conversations. Because when all, you know, when everything is theater and when everything is theater, you're just, and you're tearing each other down, you know, for clicks, and you're tearing each other down for donations, you're tearing each other down for a sort of a momentary advantage in the public mind. The long-term effect is that is they don't want to deal with each other at all, right? You know, you can call me names a certain amount of times and I can be like, well, this is business, right? This is the, you know, you don't really mean it. But at some point in time, I start to think you mean it. and I think having more space for them to engage with one another outside of the public sort of eye. And that's already happening, you know, when we think about like, oh my God, that'd be terrible for them to deliberate outside the public eye. One party is doing that already in the omnibus process, right? They create a task force to go write a bill and they pick six or seven members to do it. All those bipartisan task forces end up failing. So, because eventually, you know, like they could try to do that. But I think you have to have a sort of a culture of it. And I don't think we have that culture. And I think C-SPAN has been probably the worst thing to happen to the Congress and to congressional deliberation. Because it's really undermined their ability to work together.
All right. So if Mac Mariani wants to strengthen Congress as an institution in American life, and in your view, sort of take back some of the powers that it should rightfully exercise for the American people under the Constitution, what's a reform or a couple of important reforms? You've kind of alluded to it, suggested to it. What would you like to see in the reform of Congress?
You know, I'd probably, you know, one, get rid of C-SPAN. You know, we can read the congressional record. I'd be in favor. Hey, we can have written, you know, we can have people transcribing what goes on in committees, you know, every now and then. Maybe I think there are moments when an issue is so big and so important. I can imagine there'd be a need for a hearing that because the public needs to see this and be part of it. But most of the stuff that goes on, we don't need that. Right. Most of the stuff I think would benefit from members of Congress having a space, not in private, not behind closed doors, but not on television, right? Just take the cameras out of there. And I think it'd be significantly better. That's one. Number two, certainly I think more resources to Congress for oversight. I think that's one of the areas where now that we have a government that is so big and so broad, Congress, you know, has in some ways sought to claim back a little bit of the their power when it comes to budgets through that 1974 Budget Act, where they created the Congressional Research Service, they create the CBO. Now we have information. We're not sort of just subject to whatever the executive branch tells us. But I think they need more resources for. The problem is if you give Congress more resources, what they want to use them for is more people to manage their social media accounts and more press secretaries, right? And what we really need, and those are important and we need to have that, but I think we need, actually, probably would be better if we didn't have that, if we got rid of the press secretaries, which I feel bad because I have a lot of students who work as press secretaries. You know, more resources for committees and oversight, you know, members of, and part of this is, I mean, the biggest change, right, is that we have to reward members of Congress for spending their time on oversight. That's hard work. It's kind of boring, right? It requires you to do like homework, right? Like, and I can tell you, my students don't like doing homework and members of Congress don't like doing homework. Nobody likes doing homework, right? So that's, you know, that is a difficult thing, but giving them more resources would make it easier. And we'd see more of it. So that would be one, another, you know, probably better pay for staff. And again, in this case, it's policy staff, right? People who work on issues and legislation, give those folks better pay so that they're there for a long time. That sort of would be a balance against the fact that, you know, if you go into the federal workforce, most of those people stay for 30 years, right? They're there getting their pension. Members of the staff or members of Congress are relatively low paid, and they're sort of cycling in and out. Now, one aspect of that is when they cycle in and out, they're usually going, you know, they're taking a year off and then going and working for a lobbying firm. So another potential reform, if you want people to stay, is prevent them from lobbying Congress. You can work for Congress or you can lobby Congress. You can't do both. That, you know, that's, you know, is that even constitutional? I don't know, but that would be another one. And then the last thing is the hardest thing. Voters need to reward members of Congress for being responsible, right? For doing the hard work of legislation. You know, one theory is, you know, about why things have gotten so bad is that members of Congress realized that the way to get votes is to focus on constituent service. It's to focus on partisan theater. And it's not to focus on legislation, right? That's, again, that's homework. That's hard. And it's also politically controversial, right? When you work to pass a bill, there's somebody who likes it and there's somebody who doesn't like it. So it's a win-lose, right? When you do constituent service, that's a win-win. Everybody, you do constituent service, you spend time doing it, everybody involved is happy. That part of the job is important, and we need to have members of Congress who are, you know, what is it called, the monopoly suppliers bureaucratic unsticking services, I think is what Morris Fiorina called them. Like, they do play an important role in that, but I don't think most members of Congress are spending their time on that, though, now. I think most of it is this sort of theatrical presentation of being a congressman, right? And that's taken up more of their time than legislating, and that stands in the way. I think that stands in the way of compromise. It stands in the way of the sort of expertise that's needed to really shape legislation. And you got to build that sort of spirit of, we're Congress and we matter, and I want to defend the prerogatives of the institution. That's been completely lost, right? I mean, Democrats cheered Obama when he, you know, said he had a pen and a phone. Members of Congress on the Democratic side were, oh, that's great. He's going to pass things that we want. We're going to bypass Congress altogether, not understanding that their own roles and their own, you know, the extent that they exist as members of Congress and the political system are devalued when that happens. And, you know, flip side, when President Trump does stuff independently of Congress, Republicans cheer that on too, right? And so voters unfortunately are rewarding that. And so that's one of the challenges is figuring out how to get the voters to actually care about a responsible Congress, because until that happens, members of Congress are probably not going to do it.
Well, fascinating, sobering insight, but also one that calls the American people, calls us to think seriously about our role as citizens, as you say, in keeping Congress to the task perhaps that the founders wanted it and the role that the founders wanted it to have. Oh boy, lots to think about here. What a fascinating, interesting conversation on such an important, critically important American institution, the United States Congress. Mac Mariani, thanks for taking the time to be with us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.